The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
Well, hello, Capital Thinking. This is Joshua Green, your guest host for today, as Kevin O'Neill is off. We are super excited about our show today. We're going to have a little bit of an energy, green tech, sustainability, regulatory focus. Those of you who are loyal Capital Thinking listeners know me and my guest appearances on the show. So I'm fortunate today to be guest hosting for Kevin, and we have an excellent lineup of guests to talk today. Those are Dave Feldman, and he is joining us and will be followed by Nicole Steele of the Alliance to Save Energy, Norma Cram of Patton Boggs, and Mike Engelman of Patton Boggs, and those two are going to focus on some regulatory issues in the energy sector. But first up, we have Dave Feldman, who is joining us. Dave is the founding director of Bethesda Green, which is a collaboration of business, government, and community leaders. He's also CEO and partner in the Livability Project, a bi-coastal social entrepreneurial company that helps communities organize and accelerate local and regional sustainability initiatives and economic development. Among many of his accolades, and Dave has many, he was named one of the 25 CEOs you need to know by the Gazette, Politics, and Business, as well as the Innovator of the Year by the Daily Record, which is a local publication in the D.C. metro area. So Dave is joining us to discuss, amongst other things, sustainability, green technology, innovation, and things that are going on here close into the nation's capital, and we are fortunate to have Dave. So Dave, how are you?
Good morning, Josh. I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. So, Bethesda Green, why don't you tell a little our listeners about Bethesda Green and describe the mission there, and we can talk about some other issues as well.
Sure. Bethesda Green is a 501c3, and we're proud. We just celebrated our five-year anniversary earlier this year. And started back in 2008 as a collaboration between business, government, residents, even academics. So we looked at who are some of the key change makers within a community and brought them together under one umbrella of an organization, which as it had as its sole mission is to promote a sustainable lifestyle. And we've been very inclusive of government officials. We have the head of economic development and a council member on our team, and also some very large businesses in the community. This has been, we're not an advocacy group. We're a group that tries to work with change from a very collaborative, partner-oriented approach.
Oh, wonderful. And Dave, tell us, what made you want to start something like Bethesda Green?
Well, I came from economic development. I had a great job position previously where I was actually head of economic development at the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. And I saw how many different economic development agencies, particularly in the U.K., really focused on sustainability. And, you know, if you fly into Europe, you can see wind turbines from the airplane. If you look in the streets, you know, they have different kind of transportation systems. You know, they certainly look at more mass transit. Recycling seems to be much more of a part of their consciousness. And I thought that would be a really interesting thing to look at that within all communities. And the model was essentially based on bringing together these key leaders and connecting the dots and essentially building kind of a critical mass within a community. And, you know, business is a very important component of that. Josh, one of the interesting things that happened, and one of the things that's made Bethesda Green successful, is that we've been donated some space in downtown Bethesda. We've got 4,000 square feet, and we have converted that into an education and a demo center to help the community understand the local issues as it pertains to them. So they're part of the process, but they're also the recipients of the knowledge. And then we also have a business incubator with 17 companies that are creating the next generation technologies or food solutions or whatnot. So it's kind of part think tank, part Starbucks, part library. I mean, it really has a very vibrant hub. So, you know, the whole foundation is about bringing people together to address these issues.
Right. That's fantastic, Dave. And just tell us a little bit more about some of the companies in the incubator part of Bethesda Green.
We've got a number of different sectors that we have. We have got five companies that are in tech and technology, in clean tech and various aspects of energy and computer science, trying to make more efficiencies in various areas. We've got some food and consumer products. We've got what we call professional services. We've got a lawn care. We've got an amazing video filmmaker who does a lot of green content from an educational standpoint. And then we're unique in that we also have nonprofits. Our tech companies are actually doing some quite interesting work. We've got one company that does captures vibrations, for example, of wind. So it doesn't have big moving parts, but it captures vibrations and it translates or transfers that into electricity. And they're in an early pilot stage. There's another company that, Savinia Labs, that is actually rates appliances for their greenness. So you might have two coffee makers that both cost $99, but one might cost, you know, 10 times the other over its lifetime in energy costs. And he's providing this kind of information to consumers so they can make better and greener being both environmental and financially rewarding decisions. So it's really a cross-section.
Very noteworthy, Dave, and quite impressive, just a panoply of entrepreneurs working under the umbrella of Bethesda Green. Are there any specific events that Bethesda Green has coming up that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, we do a lot of different kinds of events, and our mission falls under three different areas. It's incubate, educate, and initiate, which is essentially helping start programs up that will green Bethesda. So on the networking side, we do a monthly happy hour, and that's just, you know, because we find a lot of people want to network and get to know each other, so that's kind of on the social side of things.
Sure, sure.
We do have a lot of training programs. We finished a financial workshop series helping some of the small businesses understand what it needs to take their business to the next level. You know, how do they raise capital? What are the sources? How do they position, describe their companies in ways that investors would understand? And we're doing a follow-on series to that program starting in January. And what that will entail is a company will come. If they're ready to put their business plan together and get it in front of investors, we will provide them very hands-on and engaging training, mentoring, and in many situations connect them to people who could eventually fund their businesses. We're also launching what I think is a very exciting program because we're in Bethesda, and for those of you who know Bethesda, there are so many restaurants. I want to say over 225 restaurants in the Bethesda area. So we are looking to start a greening restaurants program, which will bring together vendors in the world of composting, lighting, recycling, carbon offsets, electric vehicle charging stations, any number of different kinds of solutions, but working with the restaurants and helping them understand how they can initiate or implement these within their own in their own restaurants. So that program starts within the next probably 4 weeks. So we do a lot of different programs. We're doing a youth fair and internship fair early next year for companies that are looking for students, and we have a partnership with some local colleges. So quite a broad array of programs all under the sustainability umbrella.
Well, that's great, Dave.
Keeps me on my toes.
Green certainly sounds like a wonderful place, and you're doing wonderful things there. Before we leave you, let's talk a little bit about the Livability Project. We heard a little bit of that in your bio and your intro. It sounds quite fascinating. So why don't you give us the background on that and the scope of what the Livability Project does and what the mission is?
The Livability Project is actually my company that I started about 7 years ago. I have a partner on the West Coast in Sonoma County, and we both saw a way to create these kinds of local economy centers or sustainability hubs in different communities. And when I started Bethesda Green, it was based on that model. She has a project called the Share Exchange, which is out in Santa Rosa, that again brings these community stakeholders together to address these local types of issues. What we have done is create a toolkit and a framework so that any community can bring the right people together so that they can build these same kind of initiatives within their own community. So, you know, Bethesda is not unique. I mean, it certainly is an affluent community, but the same dynamics that worked in building this organization over 5 years apply to any other another community who wants to make that kind of change and bring in the right folks. So, you know, there's a Silver Spring Green right now. There's Annapolis. There's something that you're familiar with starting up in Alexandria. There's another group in Gaithersburg. There's been some discussions about both Baltimore and Washington. So essentially the whole goal is to help create these kinds of groups that are independent of government and business, but they certainly include them, and then connect these groups together where you can start sharing best practices or, in some situations, start to, you know, bring together some large-scale programs. It could be a big composting program that's statewide, for example, together. And when you have all these groups working together, you have the scale to really make an impact.
Right, right. And are there any current projects, whether it be on the East Coast, West Coast, on the Livability Project? You touched on a couple of those that is specifically timely or things that some of our listeners or others could get involved with now?
Now, it's a little early now, but next June there will be a workshop. It's actually going to be a 3-day intensive that will help other members in the community, and these could be social entrepreneurs who want to start one of these kinds of initiatives, or a business or local government folks who would like to do this in their own community, and we're going to do a 3-day workshop. We've already had interest from a number of different communities, some of these coming from outside this region, who want to be part of that. So you can visit the website, livabilityproject.com. There will be more information on that coming soon, or you can just get in touch with me. But, you know, the whole idea is right now is to continue. Sustainability has to happen at the local level. You know, we're not seeing a lot of leadership from Washington, D.C. on these kinds of issues. Plus, each area is very different. So we want to engage the local economic development folks to address issues that are local here. And, you know, the more of these that are working in our neighborhoods and our communities, the more opportunity we're going to see for, you know, a stronger economy and a more healthy environment.
Well, Dave, you know, we have our time's almost up, and I kind of fascinated, and of course, have a zillion questions. But you touched upon one thing before we leave here, and maybe 30 seconds on that, and that is the crisis and the failed leadership at the federal level, and that the local communities need to be showing more of the initiative. Are there other organizations and efforts that you would like to highlight related to sustainability and green tech?
Yeah, there are a few in the area. But there's a group called SETI, which is another green incubator up in Baltimore. It's the Clean Energy Technology Incubator, very progressive space. We do some work with them. They're a partner, and it's nice to have these cross-regional connections. There's the Maryland Clean Energy Center, which just had their big annual conference, and they bring together leaders in sustainability. There's groups both in Baltimore and Washington and D.C. There's a local first group, which
right.
does a lot of work in sustainability, but comes from a different angle. So there's so many groups that are trying to address these issues, and many of them are working together.
Great, great, Dave. And real quick before we leave you, how can people get in touch with you?
Either way, website BethesdaGreen.org or LivabilityProject.com. And my email is Dave at either one of those, Dave@BethesdaGreen.org or Dave at LivabilityProject.com.
Oh, wonderful. Dave, thank you for being on, and certainly best of luck with Bethesda Green and the Livability Project. They sound like two wonderful organizations doing many great things. So thank you for being on today.
Great, Josh, and keep up the good work in trying to promote this clean tech throughout the region. It's an important issue.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thanks.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Are you a sustainability professional or interested in learning more about the topic? then you won't want to miss the next dialogue series on sustainability on November 12th at the Washington, D.C. offices of Patton Boggs, where solar energy finance pioneer and thought leader Jigar Shah will discuss the impacts of climate change and sustainability planning, as well as his new book, Creating Climate Wealth. For more information on the event, please visit pattonboggs.com/events or on Eventbrite at pbsustainableseries.eventbrite.com.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. We're back on Capital Thinking. My name is Josh Green. I'm guest hosting today for Kevin O'Neill. Please be sure also to contact us. We're on Twitter at Capital Thinking. And, of course, our dutiful listeners understand that they can tune into the show on voiceamerica.com. We are back and fortunate to have our next guest with us, Nicole Steele, who is with the Alliance to Save Energy. And at the Alliance to Save Energy, Nicole is Director of Policy and State Relations, where she is also the staff lead on the Alliance Commission on National Energy Efficiency Policy, better known as Energy 2030 Initiative. And prior to joining the Alliance, Nicole was Director of the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Program, which was funded out of the 2009 American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, also known as the Stimulus Program. Ms. Steele was also a land use planner for a number of years locally here in Loudoun County, Virginia, and she is here to talk to us about innovations in energy efficiency and some perspectives at the state and local level. So, Nicole, welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Josh. It's great to be here.
All right. Well, for some of our listeners, certainly in the energy space, they may be familiar with Alliance to Save Energy, but for those who are listening in for the first time and listening to you, could you give us a little background on the Alliance to Save Energy?
Certainly. So the Alliance to Save Energy is a nonprofit organization headquartered here in Washington, D.C., but we do have operations worldwide. We are about a 36-year-old organization created in the late 70s after the oil OPEC crisis by Senators Percy and Humphrey, so it was a bipartisan effort between those two individuals. And we've carried on that tradition by having a standing honorary board of sitting elected officials, both from the Senate and the House, as well as Republicans and Democrats. So we're very proud of the fact that we do have that representation and interest across the political spectrum, because energy efficiency certainly is a bipartisan issue, and we're excited that, you know, people take the perspective of who's for wasting energy. So I would say that the other neat thing about the Alliance is that we do have an associate members base, which is about 150 member organizations that represent all sectors of the economy. We have big names like Siemens and Johnson Controls and Whirlpool and Schneider Electric. And then we also have great partners within trade organizations that are interested in energy efficiency, as well as universities and other nonprofits working in this space. So we're happy to be here and doing hard work in federal policy on the Hill, as well as the state and local level.
Oh, wonderful, Nicole. It certainly sounds like the Alliance is not only a broad and deep organization, but certainly its geographical scope and footprint is quite impressive. So what are the things that the Alliance is advocating and prioritizing now?
Well, so I would say our big advocacy push right now is the Energy Savings and Industrial Competitiveness Act on the Hill, otherwise known as Shaheen Portman. It's a bipartisan bill that we've been working on for almost 3 years now, and Senators Shaheen and Portman have been obviously taking a strong lead. It would bring better efficiency to federal government buildings, as well as providing the necessary tools needed to create the workforce to make that happen, as well as promoting energy efficiency in the industrial and manufacturing sectors. So it has come to the Senate floor, and so we are spending a lot of time making sure that we do have the votes to get that through. We have a very optimistic view on that we can actually get this piece of bipartisan legislation, as well as through the Senate, but also in the House, and we've been having conversations over there. So there is a lot of other conversations happening on the Hill. There were over 110 amendments filed to this piece of legislation, so it's almost being used as a vehicle to move a number of things around energy efficiency and energy, particularly at the federal level. It obviously shows that there's pent-up demand, since there hasn't been a piece of energy legislation that's come to the Senate floor since 2007. And I believe the number is that there's 87 of those amendments are actually energy efficiency germane, and another 20 or so are in the energy sphere. So there's a lot of great ideas, a number of them non-controversial, bipartisan, no cost, which would bring great benefits to, you know, this country, but then also trickle down to the state and local levels.
Certainly, certainly. And it sounds like there's a lot of activity and certainly bipartisan interest on energy efficiency. And I know oftentimes in the energy world, energy efficiency is not necessarily the sexiest of all of those new and innovative technologies. But having said that, there are a lot of innovative things that are going on, probably with some of your members, as well as at the state and local level. And I wanted to touch on that, just given your experience in implementing or help implementing the Energy Efficiency Conservation Block Grant Program at the local level, and of course your work in Loudoun County, Virginia. Does the Alliance, given obviously you do a lot of work with state policy, would love to have your perspective on what also is happening at the state and local level, and are those particular areas, whether it be state government or NGOs or other partners that maybe the Alliance is working with, are they helping to drive innovation and energy efficiency and energy policy more broadly?
Yeah, okay, great. So traditionally the Alliance has worked mostly in federal policy arena, but we have been starting to do more work at the state and local levels, particularly because of our Energy 2030 initiative. And what that was that we created a commission about a year and a half ago called the Alliance Commission on National Energy Efficiency Policy. I know it's a mouthful, so we changed it to Energy 2030.
Right.
And it brought together leaders from all sectors, Dr. Dan Arvizu from the National Renewable Energy Lab, Sue Tierney, who is very well known in the energy World and a number of others. It was chaired by Senator Mark Warner from Virginia and Tom King, who's president of National Grid US, which is a large utility in New England. But the reason we are working at the state and local levels now is because half of those recommendations were geared towards state and local governments. And so we're in the midst of actually building much more strategic partnerships at the state and local levels to really make sure that these recommendations are, you know, sort of used across the country, but also really sort of building awareness around what the goal of the Energy 2030 initiative is. And so that goal is to double U.S. energy productivity by 2030, and I think that's actually the big piece that's happening at the local levels right now. There's a big conversation about shifting the message of energy efficiency and sustainability and climate conversations more towards an economic development message, and that, you know, we're going to use energy efficiency to grow our economy, to create jobs, to be more productive. And so we're going to be more productive at home, we're going to be more productive at work and in our businesses. Why wouldn't we want to do that? And sort of, it takes us out of that sort of negative conversation that you see around energy efficiency and that you're conserving and saving and using less. So really, it's a huge, it's a shift, it's a conversation shift. Was actually after the launch of Energy 2030, President Obama in his State of the Union address adopted the goal for the nation. And so what we're really trying to do is build a grassroots momentum at the state and local level to push the federal government and the pieces of legislation that I mentioned earlier at the more congressional level.
Now, are there particular state jurisdictions or local municipalities in your experience, both at the Alliance and, of course, your prior work in Virginia, that do things particularly well, that have a greater commitment to energy efficiency? And moreover, is energy efficiency both at the industrial level as well as at the residential level, you know, our own homes, do you see a lot more work at the local level going into that, and what jurisdictions are doing things maybe better than others?
Well, certainly at the local level is where the rubber hits the road, so that's where things happen. Coming from Northern Virginia and working with the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments, I've been able to stay involved with them on their priorities in moving their policies forward that really incorporate energy efficiency steps. And so they actually made one of their legislative priorities this year for 2013 energy productivity. And so again, it's sort of adopting that message. And then in this particular region, we've been doing a fair amount of work with the DC Sustainable Energy Utility. It's obviously a new project, but we've seen a lot of great results coming out of that. I just learned the other day that, you know, if you go to the Home Depot, you can get a rebate on LED lighting, and so I was, you know, made my way over there immediately because it's a service that they do offer. Now, Arlington County, Virginia is always used as sort of an example of being in front of energy efficiency and new types of energy planning issues. Coming from Loudoun County, we were awarded by the National Association of Counties of having a model energy or community strategy, and Arlington saw that work that we did and took it a step further, and so they created their own energy strategy at a community level, and they're now actually implementing that really through really targeted energy planning and district energy planning by providing incentives to developers, particularly around developers that are interested in building at a higher density than they would at sort of the base plan level. So they give them an incentive to build in a much more sustainable, energy efficient way to get the density that they're actually looking for and actually provide the infrastructure that would be needed in order to hook up into a district energy system if that's something that they would want to tap into in the coming years. Now, in terms of across the country, Massachusetts is always a great example. They win statewide stuff. They win city stuff. So I would say that Massachusetts is, you know, always at the head of the game, as well as California and New York with their NYSERDA and REGI programs. So around green financing and everything like that.
Before we leave, because we're almost up on our segment, it's been fascinating, Nicole. Tell our listeners how they can get in contact with you as well as with the Alliance.
Certainly. So around the Energy 2030 work, it's energy2030.org. There's a lot of great resource information on that website. In terms of me, it's just I can be reached on at email in steel, STEELE at ASE. So it's the Alliance to Save Energy.org.
Well, wonderful. Nicole, thank you so much for being on the show today. I hope our listeners learned a lot more about energy efficiency and the work ASE is doing. So once again, thank you for being on, and good luck to the Alliance and all of its great programs.
Thanks so much, Josh. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Find out which guests are being featured this week. Read our network press releases and read the blog posts from your favorite hosts. Go to iradioblog.com today, powered by the Voice America Talk Radio Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Stay up to date on the latest news out of Washington affecting your business. Check out Patton Boggs' new Capital Thinking blog at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. Let one of the world's best legal and political intelligence networks keep you in the loop on the policy developments that matter to you most. Access the network today at capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com. That's capitalthinking.pattonboggs.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking. My name is Josh Green. I am your guest host today, filling in for Kevin O'Neill. Those of you listening, please don't be shy about sending us a tweet at Capital Thinking, as well as an email. You can certainly send it to Kevin O'Neill's address. I'll try to read it, but we have to make sure that we're screening our emails. I'm only joking. But our next segment, we are going to be joined, and we are joined, rather, by Norma Cram. Norma is a partner in the Patton Boggs D.C. office and is co-chair of the firm's Homeland Security Defense and Technology Transfer Practice Group. Norma provides strategic advice on key issues in a range of areas, including homeland security, transportation, defense, international trade, environmental, and a host of appropriation issues for all aspects of critical infrastructure. She's also a veteran of Capital Thinking and our go-to guru on all things related to cybersecurity. And today, Norma is going to shed some light on the critical role that cybersecurity plays in protecting and enhancing our energy grid. So, Norma, welcome.
Thank you, Josh. It's great to be on again with you.
Oh, fantastic. So we're going to have a discussion about cybersecurity and the nexus to the energy sector, the grid, and utilities. And I know this is a very important issue, certainly in the energy space, and one that you have been tracking and watching very closely as it relates to critical infrastructure more broadly. So there's been a lot of discussion about existing structures, right, that govern critical infrastructure from a regulatory perspective. So in the energy world, from your perspective and vantage point, how is the existing FERC and NERC, yes, we got a lot of acronyms are going to be flowing potentially in this conversation, how is that structure viewed by decision makers in Congress, and how are they discussing it over concerns with the electricity grid?
Yeah, and Josh, that's a great question, because when we think about the grid, they do have a very different structure than some of the other 16 critical infrastructure sectors, really as defined by the Department of Homeland Security. And they have this interesting interaction between what is the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. And it allows the industry to actually work collaboratively together under the NERC umbrella to actually create standards for themselves. They are able to vote up or down on some of the standards, and then, just to kind of dumb this down a bit, then they send it over to FERC, and FERC really kind of has an up or down decision-making on that. FERC can certainly tell NERC in some limited instances that they should work on a number of things, but you had this interesting collaborative role within the utility industry to create their own standards, and when we think about cybersecurity, they create critical infrastructure standards. They're called CIP, Critical Infrastructure Protection Standards, and they just finished one the other day. Unlike other sectors, though, most other sectors do not kind of have this very strong collaborative effort, and so there are some in Congress, and it certainly varies. Some in Congress are saying that this process doesn't work as well as it should, that maybe the industry isn't willing to create or vote on standards that are as robust as they should be. But I think the challenge for this sector, like others, is there are overlapping jurisdictions, there are legacy systems and legacy regulations. And I think the ultimate question that Congress asks when we think about this sector is, are there gaps that exist in these standards, and do we actually know where they are as they relate to cybersecurity?
Right. And earlier this year, I know that you were on Capital Thinking to discuss the president's executive order related to cybersecurity and critical infrastructure and information sharing. How does that, the executive order, and then what we've just kind of discussed, the overlay, regulatory overlay, impact the utility world?
Sure. So as most folks have seen, the president issued an executive order in February of this year. They also issued what we call a Presidential Policy Directive, or PPD 21, which specifically focused on, it's called Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience, but it's specifically focused on the energy and financial services sector. And the executive order basically laid out an outline, if you will, of a number of steps that the White House, Department of Homeland Security, and the Commerce Department needed to take, and the focus was to create, again, a public-private partnership to come up with what we call a cyber framework. The other interesting piece about the president's executive order, it included 11 major deadlines. Now, for those in the utility sector, there are a number of them that were really important. They talked about pushing out more timely, unclassified information, cyber threat information. Also talked about helping companies get additional clearances, which help them get critically needed information on cyber threats from the federal government. And the interesting one was really in July 12th. It required the Department of Homeland Security to identify what we call, quote, the most critical of critical infrastructure, i.e. those sectors where a cyber incident could have a catastrophic regional or national impact. And obviously, if you're in the utility world, you probably fit that mold. So that's a really important designation. Of course, that was a classified designation, but that has huge impacts for the utility world, both on the overall policy, what they do, but if you're designated by the federal government, they haven't really articulated what that means for you, but it does sort of put you on fair notice.
That's fascinating, Norma. So, you know, also in the energy and certainly in utility space, obviously, it's heavily regulated, as you know, and a lot of our listeners know, just between the public service commissions, public utility commissions that regulate the regulated utilities at the state and certainly the local level. So mashing all of that together with this kind of the president's executive order, the federal overlay, what's the current state of play? I mean, is there kind of a big sucking sound, a vacuum of leadership, or do we have utilities saying, well, wait a second, we need to be working on this at the local level with our PUCs and feds, you know, leave us alone?
You know, that's a really good question. I think the marketplace, if you will, within the utility space is actually asking all of those questions. So first, the point of the framework, cybersecurity framework, as defined by the executive order, was not to create a list of prescriptive new standards or regulations, but to come up with sort of best practices and maybe performance-based approaches that every sector could use. Now, again, there's the federal component, as you've talked about. There's also the state component, and here's where there's an interesting nexus. Really, for the utility world, what they need to do is to take this framework, and there are a number of utilities and energy folks have fully participated in this process, but they literally have to map the framework to their sector, to their company, to their existing regulations to see how it fits. Again, theoretically, the framework could help you identify gaps. It tries to help define different tiers of companies that's based on risk, and it might actually be a tool for some companies to make sure that their C-suite is paying attention. The other part of the executive order as it relates to the framework that's important is DHS, Department of Homeland Security, Treasury, and the Commerce Department were to create, quote, incentives for sectors to adopt the framework. And specifically for the utility world, that did include the ability to see rate recovery. So there is a federal-state partnership now on trying to identify what this means. Other things like grants, potential tax incentives, cyber insurance.
Right.
So they do contemplate this federal-state relationship, but it's a very difficult one.
Yeah, I can only imagine some of the issues and nettlesome questions that are being raised within those C-suites and boards, et cetera. So segueing back to the federal level, is there any current activity in Congress that the utility sector should be paying attention to vis-a-vis cyber?
Sure. So there's been a number of bills passed by the House of Representatives earlier in the year. The House Homeland Security Committee is working on another cybersecurity bill. That relates a lot to codification of existing DHS authorities. We still talk about the need for increased information sharing within sectors and the federal government. This is above and beyond what we see today with robust privacy protections. Those are being debated in the Congress right now. And I think to the utility industry's credit, a program they worked on with the Department of Energy, the maturity model from 2012, is actually being used by some in Congress to say, you know, there are maturity models within sectors. We need to take a look at those. And then to target information and sort of new procedures accordingly. And that's to the utility world's benefit, because if you've created this program as they did, or if they help create the framework, anything that goes forward uses that as a foundation.
Right, right. Well, given the interplays, obviously federal, state, private sector, utility, and certainly there are probably a number of other IT-related companies that are otherwise going to be involved in the space, and where you sit on a lot of the activities and boards and commissions that I know that you're working very hard on, Norma, what's your prognosis moving forward for cybersecurity and the role specifically that the private sector is going to play?
This is the core question. We have seen some, specifically in the utility world, be actively engaged with the administration, and that's incredibly important, but there are some who are not. And as we talk about the impacts on the private sector and what the private sector should do, we're really recommending four important things that every company should consider. First, you need to, as an umbrella, break down the stovepipes within your company. There are policy implications from this executive order that we've talked about. legislative implications, their compliance and regulatory structures, and their legal issues as they relate to the Securities and Exchange Commission. If you don't have a system within your company that allows you to understand what's happening in all those levels, you're going to get caught flat-footed, because at the end of the day, these four pillars, if you will, of activity will impact your company. And those who participate in the process in what we call kind of the broader vision thing can help solve problems, as opposed to sitting back and then saying, I hate the output, I don't want to deal with it.
Right. Again, it's fascinating, and the issues are certainly complex and somewhat nettlesome, but subject matter experts such as yourself are going to help a lot of people, not only in the utility industry, but amongst others, work through this so that we can get some type of working protocols that are protecting not only the grid, but some of our other critical infrastructure. So, Norma, we're about to wrap up your segment, and as always, fascinating. We always learned a lot when we have you on the show. How can our listeners get in contact with you should they have any questions?
Sure. Thank you, Josh, and thanks for the opportunity. You can contact me via email at nkrayem@patentbogs.com. And look forward to helping answer any questions that folks may have.
Very good. Well, Norma, once again, thank you for being on the show, and we look forward to having you on again in the near future.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Thanks, Norma.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be.
Listen anywhere.
Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
Are you a sustainability professional or interested in learning more about the topic? Then you won't want to miss the next dialogue series on sustainability on November 12th at the Washington, D.C. offices of Patton Boggs, where solar energy finance pioneer and thought leader Jigar Shah will discuss the impacts of climate change and sustainability planning, as well as his new book, Creating Climate Wealth. For more information on the event, please visit pattonboggs.com/events or on Eventbrite at pbsustainableseries.eventbrite.com.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
Well, welcome back to Capital Thinking. My name is Josh Green. I'm your guest host today, filling in for Kevin O'Neill, and delighted that you are with us. We're at our last segment on Capital Thinking and just some programming announcements. There is a wonderful event coming up at Patton Boggs at their Washington, D.C. offices next week on Tuesday morning. That's November 12th. At 8 o'clock in the morning, they're going to be hosting their Patton Boggs Sustainability Dialogue Series. This is a quarterly event where leaders in the sustainability field come in and have a dialogue with an intimate audience, a little Q&A where we can learn different things that are going on in the space. And this dialogue series event guest is Jigar Shah, who many of you may know is a founder and pioneer in the solar energy finance world, having co-founded the firm Sun Edison. So he'll be here. You can learn more about that event on the Patton Boggs website. That's pattonboggs.com/events, and it will be listed under the sustainability title. So back to the show and finishing off our energy-related themes, I am joined by Mike Engelman. Mike is a partner in Patton Boggs' D.C. office. He has two distinct but complementary practice areas. So for more than 15 years, he has advised energy sector clients on all aspects of project development related to independent power production, transmission development throughout the United States, as well as protecting his client interests before the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, which we heard a little bit about from Norma Cram. But Mike is here today to share some regulatory updates from FERC and give us his guidance on power generation and transmission issues. So welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Josh. It's a pleasure to join you.
Wonderful. So in our prior segment, we heard from Norma Cram, who was talking about cybersecurity related to the energy grid, and she had mentioned FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So for our listeners who are not intimately familiar with FERC, if you could just give us a quick overview of the commission, what they do, who they are, and then we can get into some other regulatory issues.
Sure. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is made up of five commissioners, two from each political party, and then a chair from the administration party. Right now, two Republicans, two Democrats, and then a chair who is a Democrat, but who has announced his resignation. And a new chair is being solicited, which we can talk about in a few minutes. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission addresses two areas. One is transmission, electric transmission in interstate commerce, and then the other is natural gas pipelines in interstate commerce. That's its primary area of jurisdiction. As Norma mentioned, it, in doing that, it addresses many areas, markets, market power, cybersecurity, and a variety of other matters related to those overarching areas of jurisdiction.
Sure. Well, thank you for that, Mike. So there are a lot of our listeners, so to kind of reverse engineer it, if you will, just from our own residential and places of work. So FERC is not necessarily concerned or has jurisdiction, as we say here in Washington, right, over how the electricity is distributed in the local streets, et cetera. They're more concerned with this greater thing that we call the electricity grid, so making sure there's balance and reliability and then the whole thing doesn't crash down on us, right?
That's correct. In fact, there was last year a power outage of the FERC facility, and their first comment was it wasn't our jurisdiction. We had nothing to do with it. So, yes, FERC, as the grid has become more integrated over the last 40, 50 years, FERC has had a increasing role in ensuring that there's coordination between each of the owners on the local level, and then how the grid interacts between those areas so that a problem in one area doesn't result in a power outage in another, as we saw, I think, back in 2003 in the Northeast, where 20 or 30 million people lost power as a result of a problem in Ohio.
Right, right. Well, one of the things I know you've been spending a lot of time on is FERC Order 1000, which seems to be a big order of FERC and has sweeping potential impacts and consequences. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about Order 1000 and how it's impacting utilities and generators and transmission operators?
Sure. Order 1000 is actually by far the most controversial order to come out of the commission in the last 10 years. And the controversial nature of the order is probably most evident by the number and the scope of parties that appealed the order, including a couple of state utility commissions, which is rather unusual. And Order 1000, the formal title of which is Transmission Planning and Cost Allocation by Transmission Owning and Operating Public Utilities.
Well, that's a mouthful.
Yes, that's extremely helpful, right? which is widely referred to just as Order 1000, was issued in July of 2011, but is still in the news because the commission gave transmission owning utilities until late 2012 to file their compliance plans with how to implement the order. And then over the last several months, the commission has been ruling on those compliance plans and then in many cases, in fact, most cases, ordering further compliance plans, finding that the initial compliance plan didn't fully comply with the order. And I think it's important to in understanding FERC Order 1000 to talk about first what we just talked about on FERC jurisdiction. FERC has jurisdiction over the rates for electric transmission in interstate commerce, but unlike its jurisdiction in natural gas, has no authority to actually site electric transmission facilities or even to require that they be built. Siting of the facilities has always been reserved to the states and state authorities. And it's that fact that has created some of the controversy, that concurrent jurisdiction between federal and state authorities. And the other thing that's created some of the controversy with Order 1000 is that there are a number of municipal co-op and other transmission owners that aren't public utilities and therefore are not subject to FERC's jurisdiction. And they've traditionally planned their transmission with entities that are subject to FERC jurisdiction. But part of Order 1000 and its cost allocation has led many of those entities shall we say, second-guess whether they should voluntarily submit to FERC jurisdiction and continue to participate in the transmission planning process.
Wow.
So Order 1000 had, as I said, two primary focuses. One is transmission planning, and then the second focus is how to allocate the costs for any new transmission facilities that come out of that planning. And the order made a couple of broad mandates on the planning side. One is that all public utilities join a regional planning group and that group actually produce a regional plan. In the past, they've been required to join a regional planning group.
But Mike, we're being interrupted, and I apologize about that. I apologize to our listeners that we had to, unfortunately, end the segment a little ahead of time than what we had. But if people have some additional questions about FERC, moreover, and Order 1000, how can they get in contact with you, Mike?
Sure. They can call me at Patton Boggs at 202-457-6027, or they can email me at mengelman, E-N-G-L-E-M-A-N, at pattonboggs.com.
All right, very good. And I apologize about cutting our segment short, Mike, but for our listeners, thanks for tuning in again to Capital Thinking. We hope you found the show useful. Make sure that you send us feedback. Send Kevin some feedback, myself as well as Capital Thinking, again at our Twitter handle at Capital Thinking, and we look forward to seeing you next Thursday right here on Capital Thinking. Mike Engelman, thanks again.
Thank you, Josh.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.